Hi. I'm still loading. So my name is Jennifer Cameron King, and I'm a third-year medical student in the UC Berkeley-UCSF Joint Medical Program. With my presentation, we're going to take a little step back even further to look at housing and how it relates to healthcare for the homeless. And my talk is entitled, Supportive Housing, How Does It Help? And I have no relationships to disclose. So I'll start with an overview of my presentation. I'll begin with some background, first looking at current issues in homelessness and health, then looking at the Housing First model as an intervention for homelessness, and finally a brief overview of social support and its relationship to health. Then I'll outline my research question and methods and present to you some of the preliminary findings from my master's research that's still still going on. And then we'll talk about some further analysis and implications of the research. So to begin with, as probably many of you here know, I'm going to be talking about the chronic homeless, which are a subset of the homeless population that spend a significant portion of their time on the street. So the chronically homeless have also been targeted because of interventions for high use of high-cost healthcare, and that's why we're particularly interested in them in public health. They're a very visible population. They make up only 10% of the homeless population of anyone who's been homeless, but they represent over 50% of people who are homeless at any given time. And they're predominantly made up of men as opposed to women. This population suffers increased rates of victimization and social isolation when they're on the street. They suffer increased rates of mental illness and substance abuse compared to the rest of the homeless population. They also have worse health outcomes with increased morbidity and mortality. About half of them are uninsured, which means that they're using more high-cost healthcare services, such as the emergency department and the psych inpatient ward, because they seek care when they've gotten really sick. And of course, they have less access to preventative care. In addition, the homeless population has been aging. I'm going to focus today specifically about elder homeless populations. This data comes from San Francisco, but it's a trend that's being seen in a number of places across the country. In San Francisco, the average age of the homeless has risen from 37 to 46 between 1990 and 2003. With an aging homeless population, combined with all of the other issues we just talked about, there's increased rates of chronic illness, such as diabetes and hypertension. Also, elder homeless people are less likely to seek out services on their own, and they have increased physical mobility limitations. Supportive housing has been implemented as a type of Housing First program. So Housing First models provide housing with few strings attached, so it doesn't require you to go through substance abuse treatment or receive services for mental illness before you receive housing. And supportive housing is the most common type of Housing First model, which provides hopefully permanent housing and includes health services, which are nearby or on site in some cases, and case management and social services on site. And the idea is to gradually engage clients in services over time rather than to require them to access services beforehand. The Direct Access to Housing Program was the first city-run supportive housing program. It was started in San Francisco in 1999. Since then, the Direct Access to Housing Program has grown to include 1,100 units in 14 buildings across the city of San Francisco. There was a primary care clinic that was opened by the city just to serve the residents of these buildings. And on-site case management and health care is provided to varying degrees at each of the buildings. In addition, the program is continuing to expand, focusing on mental illness and multiple diagnoses. So some quantitative analyses of direct access to housing are currently being done in evaluations. This is not my research, but I think it's important to underscore that supportive housing is making a huge impact on the cost of providing health care to the homeless. This chart shows one of the buildings in the Direct Access to Housing Program. The blue bars are 1 year before housing number of visits, and the pink bars are 1 year after. And each of the data points are various types of high-cost healthcare, so this like ER, med inpatient ward, and various other services. And you can see that there's a great decrease in all areas just 1 year after obtaining housing. The Direct Access to Housing Program estimates that they can save about $20,000 per person per year who's housed in supportive housing, even given the increased cost of providing new services to this population. So clearly this is an important intervention for decreasing the cost burden of the homeless population in urban environments. But also I think supportive housing provides the opportunity for social support and sense of community for a particularly isolated population. Social support and sense of community have been linked to improved physical and mental health and social epidemiology research over the last 20 years. And this has been hypothesized to occur perhaps only in times of stress, but also as a constant buoy to health throughout an individual's lifetime. So supportive housing is clearly an important intervention, but for decreasing health costs, and that's been shown in research. But very few research studies have looked at the impact of supportive housing on social support, which, as I mentioned, is also a potential benefit to individuals' quality of life, but also to their health. So my research question is, how do concepts of identity, social relationships, and sense of community change when chronically homeless elders move into supportive housing? And as I said, I'm focusing on elders because they're a particularly vulnerable and isolated population within this group of people. So in order to address this research question, I've used qualitative methods for a number of reasons. First, to understand how housing impacts individuals' lived experience. We want to know what's changing in their lives, not just in their emergency room visits. Also, to understand the process of becoming housed. And third, to understand how changes in community relationships affect health and well-being for these individuals. And finally, hopefully to develop better quantitative measures of supportive housing in the future so that we can better capture all of the benefits that are being provided to the population. So my study methods consisted of a combination of interviews and participant observation. I interviewed 18 residents at 4 of the direct access to housing buildings between 1 and 2 times with a 3 to 6 month interval between interviews. Residents were recruited through case management and health providers at each of the 4 buildings. In addition, I'm continuing to interview key informants, which are staff and providers at each of the building. And I've been attending community meetings and other weekly activities such as coffee hours, game nights, and other activities at the community to see residents' interactions with each other and staff. I'm sorry, that didn't quite come out. So data analysis first, of course, recordings and field notes were transcribed. I then have used a grounded theory methodology to analyze the data, beginning with open coding or a close reading of the text to identify categories and themes. Once I had identified a number of categories and themes that appeared to be important, I developed a code book where these themes were clearly delineated and defined. And then as I reach a point where no new categories have emerged, I'll begin to develop a model from these themes. And I've been using hyper-research software to assist in the data analysis. So I'll now present some of the preliminary themes that have emerged from the data thus far. These include the impact of aging on the effects of supportive housing, space, which I'll define more in a few moments, social relationships, and community. So first, age appears to mediate the value of supportive housing in the lives of residents. Older residents view housing differently than they might have when they were younger. There are many reasons for this, and I'll describe three of them as we go along. The first of these is, as you might expect, physical mobility. One of the biggest concerns of an aging homeless person is how they're going to continue to survive on the street as they begin to lose some of their physical mobility. And I should mention that studies have shown that the homeless population tends to have signs of aging earlier than other populations, and one of those is decreased physical mobility. I also want to mention that supportive housing provides the space to live with decreased physical mobility, but it also assists residents in rehabilitating from physical limitations that might have been more difficult to recover from while living on the street. And this was true for one resident, Rhonda, who moved into supportive housing with pains in her legs that were debilitating due to blood clots. These were resolved through an operation once she had obtained housing. And here she describes the support that she received during her rehabilitation. At first, I didn't go too many places because I had trouble with my legs and I couldn't walk too far. Now, if the staff ask me to go places with them, I'll go. At first, I couldn't climb no hills or nothing. When I got operated on my legs, I said, all right, I'm ready to travel with you. And she said, are you sure? I say, yeah, I'm ready to travel with you now. In addition, residents of supportive housing are concerned about their safety. And this is specifically with respect to younger people on the street. As I mentioned, the chronically homeless and especially the elder population suffer increased rates of victimization on the street. One resident, Arno, talked about an incident that happened when he was on his way to buy groceries. So many people don't care about an old person, you know. One guy took my money and started running with it, and I never did catch up with him. I couldn't run, you know, and he was watching me. He knew I couldn't run because I had my hospital shoes on, and he took my money out of my hand right in front of the store. So many residents also talked about the impact getting older has had on their decision to stay in housing and on their overall attitudes. This change in views was often expressed as an older way of thinking. In talking about some of the older building residents, Joe described this way of thinking this way. Because for one thing, older people, more mature people, they're more settled emotionally. So there's less immature episodes, even though we can be as immature as the next person once in a while. But it's not going to happen as much. We're mellower. So as you can start to see, aging appears to have a role both in the value and the perception of supportive housing for people as they age. So I'll now describe issues related to space. Almost all of the residents talked about the importance that physical space and the importance of the sort of actual room that they acquired. Many appreciated having just a comfortable place to be where they could shut the door and just be alone. For example, Lloyd described, I mean, there's gangsters and there's violence in the neighborhood. It's fine with me. I got my comfortable spot here. I got my little sanctuary. Everybody should have a sanctuary. Nobody wants to die cold on the street in the gutter. Comfortable spot often provides more than just physical space, but mental space as well. Relief from pressures on the street and the relief to be able to sort of reflect and process one's life. And because of this space and this sort of mental space, residents sometimes begin to see themselves differently and notice the changing perceptions of people that are around them. For example, Joseph, who struggled with staying in housing, described how people might see him in housing and how he might see himself. On the one hand, you could come see where I live at, and you would swear I was a straight and narrow guy. But it's not like that, and it's okay with the staff. I can talk to them about anything, and I always acknowledge what I call my shortcomings. And later, Joseph talks about his shortcomings as some of his struggles with mental illness and substance abuse and how those have interfered with his ability to stay in housing in the past. Many residents, though, also talked about how this space allowed them to give back to the community in various ways. Some volunteered in the community, and others began to do creative work, such as writing, painting, and photography. These activities were allowed through this creation of space, as I said. So for example, Al began volunteering with a nonprofit that served people recently released from jail. And he described it this way. I spend a lot of time in my room because I'm comfortable there. I got whatever I need there. I don't need to go out. But if someone needs my help, I try to do whatever I can. So I went down to the jail to volunteer to help people getting out of jail. I refer them to housing and get them into programs that they didn't know, like I didn't know, that were available. In addition to the themes of aging and space, social relationships and community were also changed or altered for residents in supportive housing. However, these changes varied more among residents, and often there was a range that was seen. In looking at residents' life over time, three patterns emerged of relationships. The first is that some of the residents were able to maintain relationships from their homeless life while they were in supportive housing, so they had a continuity of support. Whereas other people lost their relationships when they became homeless, and they were actually able to create new relationships and support structures once in supportive housing. Finally, some lost relationships and remained isolated in supportive housing. In addition, a range of involvement was seen with respect to sense of community for residents. All residents, it's important to note, had some sense of community or attachment to their new environment in supportive housing. But this sense of community ranged from having multiple friendships and a new support network, people who would do favors for you that you would meet for coffee, to spotty attendance at community meetings and not much interest in relating with the other building residents on a more personal level. I have two examples of this range. The first is from Denny, who's a resident who has struggled significantly with alcohol abuse. He talked about his lack of connection with the building community in this way. We're not all buddy buddies, and I don't spend a lot of time in the community room because I don't have to. But I also don't like what they watch on television, and they wouldn't want to watch what I want to watch, so it's all right. I don't feel bad because I can entertain myself. I have my books. I can read. I'm self-contained in my place. On the other hand, William, who's a resident who's very introverted and not very outspoken, really connected with the building activities and the ability to hear the views of other residents. We've got other things, meetings and stuff. There's always something happening if you want to participate. But if you don't, that's okay. But it makes you feel part of the place, you know. You have people's respect that ask you what you think about so-and-so. So in summary, there are a number of ways in which residents undergo social changes after moving into supportive housing. Their identities as elders have changed their perceptions of housing in terms of safety and security, and also in terms of their overall perceptions and views. In addition, supportive housing provides a space, both physical and mental, for residents to rest and develop new self-perceptions, which then allows them to give back to their community creatively, as volunteers, and as activists. And finally, supportive housing allows for increased social connectedness and sense of community, but not all residents participate in this benefit as much as they could. So thus far, I think my research indicates that supportive housing is an important community environment and should be supported in this way. However, in further analysis, I want to first examine the role of support staff, which clearly play a role in providing some of these opportunities for community connection. In addition, the mediating factor of substance abuse will be looked at, the relationship between some of these social support issues, supportive housing and health, and then I'll also continue to look at space and specific aspects of community behavior as I analyze the data. As with all study designs, this study has some limitations. First, interviewing residents after they obtain housing and asking them to compare their previous experience to their experience now, which will definitely include some recall bias. In addition, I've selected residents through referrals from case management and residents who volunteered, so there is some selection bias. I'm not tracking residents if they leave supportive housing, so I'm only interviewing residents who are able to stay in supportive housing. However, none of my subjects thus far, as far as I know, have left supportive housing. And finally, as with all qualitative study, this study is not totally generalizable to the population. It's a small sample size, and the program in San Francisco is somewhat unique. I want to say thank you to the residents of the Direct Access to Housing program, as well as the staff and the case managements there. Colette Auerswald, who's here, and Joshua Bamberger, some of my important mentors, and all of my other academic advisors. Thank you very much.